Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last year was one of the worst years on record for gun violence in the United States. Nearly 20,000 people lost their lives, more than any other year in at least two decades, according to data from the Gun Violence Archive. Roughly 100 people in the U.S. are killed by guns every day in this country. That is 100 people every day. Many of the homicides are concentrated in communities of color, including Philadelphia, St. Louis, Chicago, and Oakland. But these shootings hardly get national media coverage. Jeff Asher, a New Orleans-based crime data analyst, told The Guardian that the thing that stands out about last year's change in murders is that they happened almost everywhere. Omaha, Nebraska, Lubbock, Texas, Shreveport, Louisiana. All of these towns saw huge increases in murder. The United States has the biggest legal firearms market in the world, with 393 million guns in civilian hands. That is more than the next 25 countries combined. Last year, between 40 and 50 million guns were sold in the U.S. Last week, President Biden called the epidemic of gun violence in the U.S. an international embarrassment. He announced a set of executive orders to tackle this crisis, including a crackdown on so-called ghost guns, or firearms assembled from kits. Last month, the House passed two gun reform laws, universal background checks, and a ban on assault rifles, but only 8 Republicans voted in favor of that. President Biden is calling on the Senate to pass these bills. Well, today's guest, Abene Clayton, is the lead reporter on The Guardian's Guns and Lies in America series, a project investigating the initiatives that are saving lives amid this country's gun violence crisis. In a recent piece, Abene and reporter Lois Beckett write, quote, "We see that America's endless gun debate does not treat shooting victims and their families equitably. It is not driven by a focus on what actually works to save lives. It rarely includes the voices of the majority of the victims or any of the people who have a track record of successfully preventing shootings. It is not just biased. It is actively harmful and racist, and it will never make us safer. We are sad, frustrated, and angry," end quote. Hi, Abene. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, thank you. So happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I would also like to welcome our second guest, Jennifer Massia, a news writer at The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to reporting on gun violence. Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, great to have you. I just would like to ask both of you, in the wake of the last couple of weeks of back-to-back mass shootings, and even more than that, I mean, if you just search gun or shot in any news service, so much comes up. I mean, it's hard to even keep track. I want to ask you, Abene, first, how are you reflecting on the national media coverage of the latest shootings? What are your overall thoughts about how they've been covered?
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of evolved in the past few weeks, honestly, after the Georgia mass shootings at the massage parlors, followed by Boulder, the grocery store shooting. There was a very clear and those were clear and evident examples of what I write a lot about, which is kind of this disparity in coverage. And there was this feeling across many Americans that like, oh, this is coming back. You know, this is quote unquote, I saw a lot of people saying things are getting back to normal with all these mass shootings. And I immediately kind of took issue with that because I had been covering neighborhood gun violence and the uptick in gun violence all year. So it felt like really dissonant from the reality that I was experiencing as a gun violence reporter. And that's where the opinion piece that you mentioned at the top came from. And then as they kept happening, to be frank, it was really dizzying, honestly. There was another one in Southern California. And then there have been several more. There was one in DC that didn't get as much attention, and they just have happened time after time. And just yesterday, there was a shooting at a high school in Knoxville. So at first, I feel like I had a very clear picture of, okay, this is the way we're covering high profile mass shootings amid high levels of community gun violence. But in the last couple of weeks, I felt, you know, really tired. It feels like you're standing at the bottom of a waterfall sometimes. And it has been especially difficult as these more high profile incidents have continued to happen. And it's been really tough to process, honestly.
I bet. I mean, I just did a Google News search for shooting. NBC News 2 hours ago, baby killed, 2 children injured in New York shooting. 23 hours ago, KABC, man killed in police shooting after firing at officers in San Fernando, authorities say. 5 days ago, Dallas-Fort Worth, 1 dead, 5 hurt in Bryan mass shooting. I mean, it just goes on and on. Jennifer, what would you add?
I would add that these shootings never stopped throughout the pandemic. You know, everybody thought that when the world stopped, the gunfire would stop. It did not. It was exacerbated by all of the stressors that came along with the pandemic. But these shootings consistently happened in neighborhoods that when they happen, it doesn't break into CNN. And we've even as an organization done a lot of reflection over the past few days. Why do we cover, you know, mass shootings, these everyday incidents of gun violence in communities of color that have been historically disinvested? You know, they are almost like a slow motion mass shooting. You know, when you have 12 people in Philadelphia getting shot in 24 hours, as was the case a few days ago, that is considered by a hospital, you know, medics on the ground, they consider that to be trauma surgeons, a slow motion mass shooting. It doesn't break into the news like it would, you know, a random shooting in a supermarket in a predominantly white area. You know, in Chicago, 15 people were shot in a single incident. That was less than a month ago. Mm-hmm. And it did not break into the national news. So these things have always been happening, like Abene said. They're just not in communities that are getting the attention, and we're trying to change that.
Well, let's talk about this. Abene, in the piece you wrote with Lois, you go over so many issues that deserve far more attention. And let's, we have the hour, if you can stay with us a little bit past 30, so we can really talk about this and go deeper. I think this one's really important. You write that we lack the vocabulary to talk about gun violence in nuanced yet precise ways. Inaccurate and reductive euphemisms like black on black crime, inner city violence, or gang violence still frequently warp descriptions of the daily experiences of communities of color. Rarely are stories of grieving black and brown families and their deceased loved ones granted the same carefulness and language as high profile mass shootings. Perhaps it's not surprising then that many Americans still write off shootings that injure and kill multiple people in black and brown communities as gang violence, a natural byproduct of living in the hood. This is so true. Can you elaborate on this and how, what needs to change and how can it change?
Absolutely. So that, that line in particular, even just hearing it read, still rings so true. I want to key in on the lack of care and nuance that communities of color, when you're talking about gun violence, receive. You know, we have so many conversations when it comes to, and still not nearly enough, but we do have more conversations when it comes to a mass shooting about how are we going to talk about the victims? When do we show their faces? When do we say their names? How do we talk about the shooter? Do we bring up mental health? Just all of these considerations go into covering these high profile incidents, and rightly so. However, that that care and attention to detail and getting the story right is not extended to include communities of color. And like I said, living in the hood, it's still talking. It's still talked about in news, like, oh, this is just what happens. Man shot on corner, second shooting in 2 days. You know, we don't talk about whether it was a retaliatory shooting. There's no follow up. There's no or very limited conversation with the family members, you know, to understand who that person was. And there's no effort to lionize, which is something I say often, there's no real effort to lionize the folks who are killed on city streets, like in Philadelphia and Chicago and Oakland, and even some of these smaller cities. You know, they're seen as, this is what happens when you live in the, and when you live in this neighborhood, rather than it being a commentary on the larger issue of gun violence in America, which all shootings are, whether they're done by, you know, this kind of lone wolf archetype, whether they're done by someone in the streets or by a, you know, by a police officer. The gun violence is gun violence. And in terms of the language bit of it, that's something I've been learning a lot about. I always knew that I was very disturbed when the term black on black crime came up, when the term gang shooting came up, because it's like, what is that? What does that even mean? You know, there's no actual precision there, particularly when it comes to quote unquote gang shootings. I think we see black on black violence a little less, and most people know that to be a very racist, not even a dog whistle, just a really racist sentiment. But when it comes to things like calling something a gang shooting, or just taking solely the word of the police rather than reaching out to violence interrupters and these people in communities who are regularly ringing the alarm about what's going on, when we call something a gang shooting without going back and at least confirming, asking the police what gang, where, how, who, you know, asking these sort of questions, it simply doesn't happen, and it gets printed. And that's how more racist stereotypes continue. And that begets more of this disparity in attention that I talk about, because it begins to feel like, oh, this isn't our problem. This isn't something we can legislate our way out of. This is something that people who live a quote unquote certain lifestyle or live in a certain neighborhood deal with. And it's not something that the rest of America can or should address. And a lot of it is because of the way we talk about it, especially as journalists who kind of set the narratives. I've been a little bit heartened, and it feels odd to say, a little bit more heartened at the fact that some of these shootings that happen on city blocks and across city blocks and at block parties are finally called mass shootings. You know, there was a real resistance even just a couple years ago to refer to them as such. People were like, oh no, that's a retaliatory shooting. That's a gang shooting. But it's like, mm-hmm. You know, let's talk about it just in terms of numbers. If four people are shot on a given city block, there are very, you know, scientific and reputable definitions of a mass shooting that ought to be standard practice in newsrooms. And they're only just now kind of coming to fruition. And it's disheartening to see. And in terms of doing better, I think just having, you know, I was in a thing with Columbia Journalism Review, and we were talking about how these places that are resource hubs for journalism should have some sort of perhaps a style guide, best practices, something that reporters who do want to do better can refer to if they want to talk about gun violence without continuing to be harmful and racist. We need that to be somewhere, and there can be consensus and there can be discussion, but it absolutely needs to happen so people aren't just left to their, you know, subjective biases about what certain incidents of gun violence should be called. Because like I continue to say, that just makes the disparities more large, you know, and that just makes them more acceptable for some people. So I could go on and on about that topic in terms of like language and how we talk about, you know, grieving black and brown mothers versus grieving usually white suburban families. But, you know, I'd love, you know, I don't know if we have time for the whole thing.
Well, you bring up so many important points. And Jennifer, you said that your newsroom is really talking about these issues. When it comes to the language you use, tell us what that conversation sounds like and what has possibly changed over the years.
Well, like Abene said, like, you know, 5 years ago, calling, you know, a shooting at a cookout in Philadelphia, mass shooting, was kind of shrugged upon by the greater media. But there was an incident a couple summers ago. There was a shooting at the Gilroy Garlic Festival where like 13 people were shot, and most of them were wounded. There were a couple fatalities, and almost the exact same victim count 24 hours later in Brownsville, Brooklyn, and the same ratio of, you know, dead and injured, and the media covered it completely differently because Gilroy, California, you know, was a largely, you know, it was a festival, largely white area, and, you know, this was in Brownsville considered to be, well, that happens there. And we actually wrote about it and we explored that. Like, why was this mass shooting ignored? Almost the same, you know, attributes. And then the other one, you know, wasn't. It was breaking into national news. You know, the reason these terms, these offensive racist terms, like, you know, black on black crime, that's just a reason that, you know, white people of privilege use to say, we don't have to care about this, because that's what they've been doing with these communities for decades and decades. And all it does is just, you know, heighten those divisions. It gives everyone really in society an excuse to just not confront the fact that these are systemic problems that have been going on for, you know, hundreds of years in this country. And that gives people an excuse to say, well, it happens there. Let's focus on, you know, it could happen to you in a supermarket randomly, mm-hmm. Because that's what viewers and readers want to know. Can it happen to me? The truth is that these mass shootings in these communities of color, they have an impact that reverberates. There is trauma here. And that needs to be addressed. These communities are riven by this violence. And, you know, that trauma will bring all of society down eventually. You know, you cannot have this lopsided, you know, it does affect all of society. And, you know, this administration is actually unprecedented in pledging billions of dollars in community investment specifically to address the root causes of gun violence. So there's kind of, and he, President Biden included it in his jobs plan. So he is tying this problem to the economic prosperity of the entire country, almost as an acknowledgement. We can't have this going on. We can't have this continue and expect to all be economically healthy, because we all are a part of this. We have to engage. This problem is not intractable. It's just that the solutions are not quick and they're not easy and they're not sexy, and they make white people in power confront things that they don't want to confront.
Well, and to that point, you know, talking about this in a very frank way, Abene, you also write that scared of parroting Fox and other conservative media, progressives often shy away from having these honest discussions about gun violence that's concentrated among lower income Black and brown communities. And you write, this deflection from the reality of gun violence does a disservice to those who've had their lives upended by shootings and allows their stories to be hijacked by those who only talk about gun violence to call out the failures in so-called Democrat-run cities. This is such an important point. How do you think the progressive community should talk about this? Because, yeah, it's not brought up in a very, as you say, frank and honest way.
100%. I think something that I've noticed a lot of, and from very, you know, well-meaning and by all estimations, anti-racist folks, is this unwillingness to be uncomfortable with the reality that, you know, besides suicides, which are the overwhelming kind of majority of gun violence is suicides. And I always like to put that out there. But right after that are these community shootings that are contributing to low life expectancy, you know, for Black young men a lot of the times, and young Latino men and women, and it goes on and on from there. And there's this unwillingness, I think, to say anything that can be misconstrued and can be used as a sort of device to say, oh, well, Black people are just inherently violent and dangerous. You know, I think there's a real fear that any mention of the true realities of community gun violence will be hijacked anyway. So let's just kind of shy away from it. I think that we just, you know, those in the progressive community and officials who are more on the Democratic side and are there and are down for this social safety net and things of that nature, just are going to have to really get comfortable with the discomfort, you know? Mm-hmm. Like I say in the piece, if we don't, then those, the conversations about community gun violence, unless it's someone, you know, like myself or the people at the Trace who are doing wonderful work, we're going to be the only ones who are really talking about it besides the Fox News and Newsmax, who are just going to say, look at this carnage in Chicago. And, you know, then it's really going to be racist. So I think just being able to talk about the facts, you know, there's no call to talk about it in this, Black on Black violence is as bad, so let's call for more policing. I think that's another one of the fears, that carceral solutions are going to be thrown at it if the realities are discussed. But if we talk about it in frank ways and include the people most affected, crime victims, and talk about what they need and elevate those voices, then that is really something that I think Democratic and progressive officials could do well if they get comfortable with talking about shootings when it is perhaps a young Black man and another young Black man. Like, this happens, and there's no truly good reason to shy away from it besides the fear of it being misconstrued. But if those people are educated, you know, and I'm referring to the kind of more progressive and left side that we mentioned in the piece, if those people are educated, then there's no real risk of that. Then you'll know what to say. Then you'll know how to keep this conversation centered on reality and still rooted in anti-racism. But if you never pursue these conversations, you simply won't learn. And the only time we'll hear about gun violence in Oakland is, like I said, you know, myself or the Tracer, someone who's doing really great work, or local news, which can be very reductive and in some ways harmful. Or, like I said, these more conservative outlets who use it as a talking point to say that liberalism is a failure. And all three of those options continue to do a disservice. There's only a couple news sites that are doing it right. And we just have a couple stories here and there about a shooting. And then all we have is like Tucker Carlson. That's a real disservice to the stories that can tell us so much about ourselves, but simply aren't being told because of lack of information. And just like I said, that unwillingness to be okay with discomfort, you know, sure, it's a stereotype, but we can still combat those stereotypes within this conversation. It's possible, you know, but that hesitancy is so real.
It is so real. And one of the stats that you put in your piece is that year after year, more than half of all U.S. gun homicide victims are Black boys and young men between the ages of 15 and 34 make up just 2% of the population, but account for 37% of gun deaths. That was in 2019, according to the CDC. And Jennifer Abene makes a good point. In order for this to change, we have to talk about this openly, and as she writes, through a lens of racial equality. So what are your thoughts about that? That this is a tough conversation to have, but in order for things to change, it's got to be out there in an open way. So what are your thoughts about how you and your colleagues tackle these issues from that lens?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is, you know, like Abene said, local news. I mean, we're not going to be the reporters who parachute in, you know, who report on a shooting in a community and then leave and then never, you know, talk about what's underneath it. You know, local news coverage can be reductive in the way that victims need to be portrayed, according to them, as like, quote unquote, innocent. You know, otherwise, if a victim has a past as a perpetrator, possibly, or a suspect, or has a criminal record, that is used as a reason to not tell that story. When the truth is, it's a much richer story. It's a story of trauma and cycles of trauma being perpetrated again and again and again. And a lot of times, people who have been shot have been involved in other shootings, you know, and you know, perpetrators sometimes have, you know, been shot. And so this cycle continues. And the problem is that, you know, one thing that would help is going in and telling the stories of this. You know, a lot of outlets don't have the resources. We wish that we could do it with a number of different stories, but we have to pick and choose. Setting standards, in journalism schools is an excellent idea, because then it's immediately that message is, you know, these are people, these are not just, you know, sometimes they're not even identified in these local news stories. I mean, it's a disservice across the board. And gun violence is something that is happening in every news market. And because it is a beat that is going to be with us for the next several decades, some kind of standards and some kind of humanizing of these people, they're not just unidentified subjects. You know, they have legacies of trauma that is continuing, and this situation helps it continue.
Right. Well, we're going to talk after our break about how to really dive in and tell the stories of that trauma. That's Jennifer Macia, a new at The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to reporting on gun violence. Abene Clayton is the lead reporter on the Guardian's Guns and Lies in America series. This is a project investigating the initiatives that are saving lives and this country's gun violence crisis. Last year was one of the worst years on record for gun violence in the United States. Nearly 20,000 people lost their lives. About 100 people in the U.S. are killed by guns every year. And just to give you some latest data, the Gun Violence Archive just reported that the first 3 months of the United States saw 4,500 gun deaths, 8,100 gun injuries, 100 mass shootings, 200 children shot, and then 6,000 suicides. We'll definitely do another show about that. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Dr. Eugene Richardson will join us to talk about his new book, Epidemic Illusions, on the coloniality of global public health. He says health systems in the global South are neglected and underdeveloped as a way to keep them dependent on wealthy donor countries. And he says that we are seeing this play out with the vaccine rollout. So many wealthy countries are hoarding doses. So we're going to talk with Dr. Eugene Richardson about how to decolonize global public health tomorrow. And then we are going to do a show on Thursday about the police shooting of Dante Wright, a 20-year-old black man who was shot dead by a police officer during a traffic stop on Sunday. He was killed by Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter. And we will talk about this horrific shooting and other just police violence in general at a time when the George Floyd trial is still happening. In fact, it was just down the street from the shooting. Today, we are talking about the epidemic of gun violence in the United States. What are your thoughts about media coverage, being really honest about what is happening right now? Because how do you get to the root of these problems without being honest about this crisis? What are your thoughts? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Jennifer Macia, news writer with The Trace. Abene Clayton is a reporter with The Guardian. Abene, just reading these stats from the Gun Violence Archive, the first 3 months in the U.S., I mean, this country needs healing. I mean, there's so much that's wrong with these numbers. What are your thoughts about, I mean, there's so many also different levels of gun violence. We saw last year the worst years on record for gun violence. And then you've got intimate partner violence, you know, domestic violence, for example, the mass shooting. So there's different levels of gun violence. But at the end of the day, we need major, major change in this country. And that gets to the root of these problems that we're talking about. What strikes you about the people on the ground that you interview in some of these communities about the desperate changes that are needed on the ground?
Yeah, I think a few things come to mind. One being the just red tape and bureaucracy that so many families whose children tend to die in the hood face when they need victims compensation, when they need healing. I've talked to so many mothers usually who talk about just not wanting to live at all after their child is killed. But there is this, I don't even know what to call it. There's just this expectation for them to move forward. And I think it goes back to like, well, you know, you live in the hood. This is something that happens. Like that weight is on them. That expectation is on them. But I talk to so many women who are like, I could not get out of bed, but I got other kids. I got to go to work, you know, who are ready to truly end it all. And if not for the people who, without, you know, good gun violence coverage would go nameless, these local people who volunteer, who put their own money up to gather groups of grieving families together on like, well, Zoom now, but who gather groups of families together, who bring food, who connect folks with resources that aren't through the government, because there are so many issues with California, specifically Victims Compensation Board. People get rejected left and right for all kind of arbitrary things. And it is a very, honestly, racist and classist system. So people, if people even know that that exists. So we have all of these folks who work in communities to help rebuild, to help people address their trauma, to set them up with counseling and therapy services, who are doing it out of the goodness of their heart and out of their own wallets and pockets sometimes. Like I said, bringing food to make sure that the children, the living children are fed when the parents cannot go on, because one of the worst things that could ever happen to somebody has happened, you know? And I think that highlighting and uplifting those people and showing how important they are is something that can really contribute to this conversation and move it forward and move it beyond just the kind of the racial dynamics and any stereotypes at play. I also think that, and there's been more of this lately, which I've been very encouraged to see, a lot of attention on violence interrupters. These people are skilled, you know, people call them credible messengers, wounded healers. There are all kind of different names, but the job really is usually a lot of formerly incarcerated people who go into communities, work 7 days a week to diffuse potentially deadly situations, who reach out to and wrap their arms around this very small population of cities that are responsible for the majority of gun violence. And these are the people who, when we see shooting here, you know, shooting there, three people shot, child killed, these are the people, you know, these community healers, I call them, who go and bring the food, and then the violence interrupters who go into the communities. These are kind of the unsung heroes that are keeping or doing their best to keep cities from imploding and falling into complete despair. And they do so often on shoestring budgets or budgets that do not exist at all, off of the goodness of perhaps donations and one-off philanthropic grants. And these are the people that I focus often on when I do my on-the-ground reporting, and there simply isn't enough support for them. And people don't even know that this is a viable thing that they could do, you know, to help support some of these efforts. So that's one thing that I always like to highlight when I talk about what I see going on in communities, is that there are so many helpers who are doing it on their own outside of the view of police, DAs, formal victim compensation boards, and are just making it really happen for people who are on the brink of complete despair because of gun violence.
Right. And Jennifer, you report that researchers generally agree that these kinds of programs can be beneficial if they're implemented appropriately. You report that New York City neighborhoods served by a city-operated violence interruption network averaged a 40% reduction in shootings between 2010 and 2019. A similar violence interruption program was credited with helping drive a 50% reduction in homicides in Oakland between 2009 and 2018. Can you tell us more about these programs?
Yes. These are programs that are staffed by people who understand why disadvantaged communities are drawn to violence. They've been through it, and they really want to stop that cycle. In places like Los Angeles, that cycle is intergenerational. You know, you have people who have been in that life their grandparents even now, they don't want that for their children. So they will take very low paying jobs. And I examine this in several cities. The pay is sometimes lower than Walmart. And they're doing it because it's just purely out of love. They want to personally, like, have a hand in stopping this. And it really shows you what a society's priorities are, that these programs are so poorly funded. That is beginning to change. I hope, I see it. I see a lot of talk about it. And I think that, you know, we have a situation where a lot of these groups have come together to form a coalition to lobby the federal government for funding. And it is working. It is falling on receptive ears in the White House. They're hyper-local solutions. This isn't lawmakers in a room, you know, passing gun laws that are probably going to result in the incarceration of more people of color. This is a solution on the ground, diffusing conflict. You know, when there's some kind of neighborhood conflict, these people are often on call 24 hours a day. They're not paid for overtime. They will step in and they will try to mediate, and they've lived it. So they do have that credibility. And we've seen it work in cities like Oakland, Los Angeles, New York, all over the country. And so there is a real movement toward that rather than criminal justice solutions, which again results in the imprisonment of Black and brown people. This is, we're going to reinvest in communities. Hopefully this is just the start. There really needs to be a realignment of priorities to bring these credible messengers into violent hotspots.
You know, your point about priorities is so, so important, because as you say, these groups are doing this on a shoestring budget. And imagine if these groups had the money that they needed, what kind of changes they could make in their community. And so then that brings up this $5 billion plan for community-based gun violence prevention programs that President Biden announced. This would be over 8 years. Jennifer, you report that how the funding would be allocated is unclear at this point.
Yes, they want to give funding. Of course, this bill has to pass, right. You know, and there's a lot of politics that are going to go along with that. We don't know if it's going to be watered down. It's, I think, the biggest pledge toward reducing gun violence, at least community gun violence, in our nation's history. They want to earmark this for established groups on the ground who have a track record of, you know, reducing violence. I don't know if there's going to be any kind of evaluation or test. There are some more established groups who've been around longer and who have presence in multiple cities. We don't know if they're going to get priority. You know, we're looking into whether smaller groups, is there going to be an application process, like funding for the Violence Against Women Act? You know, they pick a number of groups in a number of states, the federal government, and just allocate that money. Is it going to be like that? Are cities going to decide which groups get the money? We're going to be looking at all of these things as it goes forward. You know, there are smaller, less proven groups that may be locked out of funding. And, you know, we want to see how that's going to play out.
Ebene, can you also talk about that? I mean, it's when you think about the priorities of this country, so many of these small organizations doing such important work are barely getting by. Mm-hmm. And what a little bit of money could change on the ground is incredible. So what are your thoughts on this potential $5 billion investment in these gun violence prevention programs?
Yeah, I definitely agree with much of what Jennifer just said, and had a conversation with a violence interruption group yesterday, one of the more well-known ones, Advanced Peace, that's been credited with really, really improving things in Bay Area cities, including Richmond. And they started a new program in Stockton that's showing really promising results. They're one of the more well-known ones. They have pretty... even though they are operating on less than $900,000 since their pilot in 2018 and have saved the city millions in emergency and police response and are very well known, they still find themselves quite under-resourced, especially when it came to the pandemic. So I think that this $5 billion, just the acknowledgement, there's something valuable to that. But if the allocation isn't right. You know, if the majority, if we find, you know, God forbid, like a couple of years from now, that the majority of that money went to like administrative costs and went to just building the infrastructure to get the money out, then that's going to be absolutely devastating for so many of these smaller groups who may not have a connection to Washington or even to their state representatives. And a major issue is that the grants that people depend on are one kind of few and far to come across and, you know, usually last for maybe a year or two. And if you don't already know how to go about either grant writing or grant application process, you're locked out of that money. And it makes these sort of equity programs very inequitable. You know, if there's no real solid way and no proven way to get money from the federal government to local municipalities and then to the groups that are doing the work on the ground who may not even have like a website, then I just don't know how successful these things are going to be in a model that I think could even work, you know, during when there was this explosion of COVID cases in prisons and people were being released at increased rates and these well-known and larger reentry programs in California, the Anti-Recidivism Coalition comes to mind. They were given a pot of money to then dole out on their own to the groups that they were connected with in very small cities, in very rural places in California. But those were places that they had a relationship with, that they knew had the capacity and the will and the desire to do this kind of work, but weren't connected to the governor's office in the same way that ARC was. And I think that that could possibly be a helpful model. You know, even a group like Advanced Peace that's larger and gets a lot of national acclaim still works with and is very familiar with individuals, groups of two or three people who are organizing and trying to do really good work, whether it's to heal people and deal with their PTSD or to do things like youth development. You know, there are so many small pockets that contribute to decreases in gun violence. But I just worry that, like I said, most of the money may go to like administrative costs, or there will just be so much red tape that the small groups that this money really, I think, at its heart is kind of earmarked for, these very local groups, they simply won't get it, or they won't get it in a meaningful way. You know, sustainability is a very important part of this. If a violence interrupter is, you know, worked completely to the bone, isn't making enough money, has to take on a second job and then do violence interruption on top of it, it simply is not sustainable. There has to be an ability to recruit people, to train them, and to make this a true career. 401k, health insurance, dental, the whole thing. It absolutely has to happen. Or without that, this work doesn't grow and it doesn't advance. And we don't see the gains that we so desperately need in gun violence reduction.
Such a good point. Abene Clayton is the lead reporter on the Guardian's Guns and Lies in America series, a project investigating the initiatives that are saving lives amid this country's gun violence crisis. Jennifer Macia is a news writer at The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to reporting on gun violence. We don't have that much time left, but I wanted to ask both of you about some of the other changes that the Biden administration is proposing. Jennifer, things like assault weapons bans, background checks, that is all very important. And these are modest changes. I mentioned at the top that after the Sandy Hook massacre killed 26 people, including 20 children, President Obama at the time was certain that these modest gun control measures would pass. But at the last minute, after massive pressure from the right-wing media, the bill died by only 5 votes, just 5. And only 3 Republican senators even voted for the bill to begin with. And Obama had to stand there with crying parents who did not expect that this modest bill would go down. But that's where we are politically. Now, those measures are very important, but a lot of people on the ground say, It's not just about creating these tough laws. They're important, but it's about where we invest our money. And so you have to do both. And the investment in the communities is often the piece that does not get as much attention as these, changes, for example, in law.
Yeah, I mean, what people are clamoring for on the ground is not, necessarily more gun laws, because they've seen, a lot of gun laws have come about because of crime bills. And we all know the other side of that story, mass incarceration. So, in a way, people are starting to look past the federal government for gun laws. There have been a lot of advances in state governments since Sandy Hook. A lot of laws have passed on the state level. Of course, your law in your state is only as strong as the law in the next state because it's so easy to bring guns across state lines. But it is something, so federal would help. But also, when gun reform is on the ballot in the form of ballot initiatives, voters tend to vote for it. In the past 6 years, several states have passed universal background checks. But right now, there is a background check bill in it's been passed by the House, passed along to the Senate, where, of course, we have a 50-50 split. There are a couple of other bills. There's a safe storage bill. Violence Against Women Act has a number of provisions aimed at disarming people convicted of domestic violence. Absent filibuster reform, these things are just not going to pass. So President Biden also unveiled executive actions. And, he wants to direct the Department of Justice to regulate do-it-yourself ghost guns, which don't have serial numbers. Yes, you can, build your own gun. In this country, you are supposed to have a serial number affixed, but not everybody does, and they are showing up in crimes. Reports on gun trafficking, something that hasn't been done in decades. The Department of Justice Biden has directed the DOJ to create a model red flag law that states can adopt. 19 states have laws that temporarily disarm people who might be a threat to themselves or others. But most gun violence is happening, in neighborhoods. That's where the investment piece comes in. And instead of addressing it as a criminal justice problem, addressing it as an investment problem is, definitely a departure and a change. And, one that will probably see results faster than the federal government will pass any new laws. Right. So people are definitely looking past the federal government. Sandy Hook, it inspired a generation of gun violence reduction policies and groups, but it also it showed people that change might not happen in Washington. Mm. So you've got to make plan B, C, and D. And that's what's happened.
Well, and if anyone wants to watch specifically the clip about what happened after Sandy Hook and why that bill died after so many people were certain that it was going to pass, I highly recommend this Frontline documentary called America's Great Divide. And it was just devastating to see these parents who came to DC and were certain the bill was going to pass. And at the last minute, it didn't. Again, it's called America's Great Divide. Abene, what would you add on that question around, needing these modest measures and then the need for massive investment in communities on the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. I always like to, whenever I'm answering a question like this or similar, like to preface with, of course, there is value and necessity to federal guidelines. I think things like universal background checks and maybe even some national standard for red flag laws, waiting periods, all of these different things can be quite valuable. My only concern remains that the amount of focus and resources that go to these, what really are quite modest measures when you look at the kind of panoply of issues with gun violence, is that it does end up obscuring the true burden that we've talked about, which is what's happening in communities, which I don't know that will be solved by universal background checks or research and things like that, which are valuable, of course, but I don't know that they really get to the heart of what is going on in communities, which are things like racial inequities, structural racism and violence, access to firearms, a lack of gun tracing to even know, to even have the statistics so that communities can go to their public officials and say, hey, look, we have the paperwork. You know, this isn't just an anecdotal situation. We have actual hard data and proof of what we're dealing with, which is a burden that no one should really have to carry after their community has been traumatized in this way. But it's something that public officials will use to perhaps say, oh, not right now. We don't have the numbers on that. But what we do know is that, you know, mass shootings are this horrible scourge that we need assault weapons bans on. And I think a part of it is, like Jennifer talked about, just these investments, you know, and they have to be sustained. And I just worry that once we pass, if ever it does happen, because it seems like a perpetual stalemate, if there ever is an assault weapons ban or universal background checks or registry passed, then people may say, oh, we did it. Mm-hmm. All right. Gun violence is solved, handled. We've been trying to do this in Sandy Hook. We finally did it. There will be, you know, parades and celebrations in the street. The large gun violence organizations will send out gleeful emails and press releases, and then folks will feel like they can move on again, when in reality, that's kind of that's just not going to address that the true cost and the true issue, which can't be necessarily looked at as an issue of gun restrictions or a criminal justice issue. It's a, you know, it's a social issue. It's a racial equity issue. It's a health issue. It's a mental health issue. And it's harder to legislate those type of things, which is why investments are really the way to go, to make sure that groups that have been doing this work for years, that do have a proven track record. Thankfully, there is a good amount of research since this, you know, Boston Miracle back in the 90s that proves that this kind of targeted intervention, it works, but it's just not sustained. And I think that looking there first is one, something that is less partisan. I have talked to more conservative, like sheriffs for different stories, and they will say like, no, you're not gonna like, no, we're anything that limits access to guns or makes us have to wait is a no-go, but have been more honestly open to investments in things like violence prevention and youth development and community centers. That is something that is far less partisan, unless you're talking about, you know, people not wanting to spend billions of dollars, but is not as contentious. And sorry about that, is something that can get done and can be allocated well, but we just have to know where to look, where to put our attention, and where to put our care, which is something that we are still struggling to do, I think, as a nation. We're getting there. I think we're getting closer with conversations like this and with the additional attention that mine and the Trace's work has been getting. It's on its way, but we're still quite a ways off from the real progress that's going to make a difference, right now at least.
Ebene Clayton is the lead reporter on The Guardian's Guns and Lies in America series, and Jennifer Macia is a news writer at The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to reporting on gun violence. Ebene and Jennifer, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.